A rich tradition. College Football Podcast is now live.
Hello and welcome to A Rich Tradition College Football Podcast. I'm Spencer Van Horn. He's Robbie Steltenpole. Two friends, one love, and that is college football. Rob, I think we owe everyone an apology. It's been, me owes everybody an apology. It's been a little, while since we've last recorded.
It has been a month, Spencer.
It feels like it's been a lot longer than that.
It does. But guess what? It
is holidays, okay. The new year.
Yeah, like
all those things.
You're traveling with the basketball team, and then for what, 3 weeks of December, I didn't have a computer to record with you. So right. It's now my computer is fine, obviously, since I'm here now. We have just had a rough go of it, but you know what? We're here in time for the greatness. We are here for the possible first back-to-back champion in over a decade, or the first team since Bud Elliott has created it, the first team to break the blue chip ratio. I don't know what's going to happen, Spencer, but it's going to be exciting.
Yeah, very cool article earlier today from Bill Conley at ESPN, and he went through all of the last four people who repeated as champions, last four teams that repeated as champion that did not include a split. So like 10 teams have done it since World War II, but only four of them have done it without there being like a share of the title. And I believe that was obviously Alabama, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and somebody from the 40s, and I'm drawing a blank on the 40s, but Oklahoma did it in the 50s, and then someone did it. Oh man, I'm drawing a blank on all the people, but obviously Alabama did it when they did. Nebraska was in the 90s, and then somebody in the 40s, and I'm drawing a blank on it. But either way, it hasn't been done very often, and even the great and powerful, almighty, all-knowing Nick Saban was only able to get it done once, and that's how incredibly difficult it is.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to break down the game here in a minute and make our picks and stuff, but I'll just save it. I'll save it for in a minute. Spencer, I would kind of go out on a limb and say this has been one of the best bowl seasons as a whole. Like, all the big bowls were fairly good, especially from like the 29th on. We had some really good games. Did you kind of feel that too? Or were you a little disappointed, or how did you feel?
No, I think when you consider the opt-outs and you consider sort of the potential for a good majority of the bowls, and I guess there was a good majority that kind of fell flat and sort of felt like, it's hard to get excited, or it's hard to take that final serious, knowing so many players had opted out. For the number of times that did happen, you certainly had to applaud and say, okay, you know, we definitely got several really nice looking games. There was a nice, obviously, the Tulane and USC finish, and several of those right there with the obviously the two playoff games, and then Oklahoma Notre Dame and South Carolina and Oklahoma and FSU and all. So yeah, no, I think we got a lot of really, really fun games throughout bowl season. And I mean, I was glued to it the entire Tennessee Clemson game. It kind of felt like that opened up slowly with the 31-14 final.
Have you watched the Coach 30 for the Tennessee Clemson game?
No, I have not. No,
it might be his best one. You should go watch it.
Okay.
And look, I do want to say this really quick before I ask you this big question, which leads into our discussion. I do want to say that we understand that there has been a bunch of news and stuff that has passed over the past month, month or so since we've been able to record. We are going to maybe in the next week or two, we will have kind of like a flashback episode where we, where we go and, recap the news that we may have missed, or things like that. So just know that that's coming, guys. But Spencer, I want to ask you kind of a question. If you had to pick like two bowl games that just like are going to stick with you after this bowl season, what are they?
Yeah, so I think I'm going to go Florida State and Oklahoma. I think it was really fun to see Florida State kind of wrap up their year with a big game. What a
year. God, what a year.
Yep. Jordan Travis wrapping up his with a big performance, 418 yards passing. Obviously needed every little bit of it. So it's good to see Florida State go out with a bang, and it was good to see kind of Oklahoma go out with a little bit of a big surge as well. Sort of like, had we been healthy all year, this is kind of who we could have been, and being right there toe-to-toe with another really good team in Florida State. So they're 6-7, I think, with at least this performance, you feel like, and a healthy Dylan Gabriel one last time. It's kind of like, hey, man, that team might have been a little bit better this year had, you know, they been intact all the way. That's not to say they don't lose some of the games that they lost, but maybe they play a little bit better with their, you know, with their number one quarterback and, you know, that first year under Brent Venables looks a lot better.
No, yeah, I think I would truly say that Venable or not Venables, oh my gosh, FSU. It's Mike been Norvell. Rough. Huh?
Mike Norvell.
Thank you. My brain is just gone. Mike Norvell, he would have been one of my top coaches of the year. Just from, yes, he went to the transfer portal again to try to take care of some position groups. But, you know, Jordan Travis, you know, if he doesn't get injured or if their team doesn't suffer from the ton of injuries that they had this season, I really do think that Jordan Travis may have been in New York for the Heisman Trophy. Or, you know, I'm calling this right now. I really do think they win the, I think they win the ACC next year. Like, I'm pretty confident in, unless something drastic changes, I'm probably going to pick FSU to win the conference. Because I agree with you. That FSU game was really awesome to watch. What was another bowl game that really stuck out to you?
Yeah, so I guess we're including the playoff games, or did you want to save those for a separate conversation? Because obviously I did not see TCU and Michigan having the back and forth that they did. I was certainly surprised. I had Michigan in that game and certainly thought that they would sort of just overpower TCU. And so the fact that the Horned Frogs did every which thing, and it was kind of interesting to see Michigan almost go away from the things that they wanted to do or have been doing for the majority of their year, kind of became a little bit more of a pass-heavy team and didn't completely abandon the run, but at the same time, they didn't have it at their disposal like they probably would have wanted to. But definitely an interesting back and forth between TCU and Michigan. And I think you can even make the argument that Max Duggan didn't play his best game and they're still able to win by 6.
Yeah, no, that game was, you know, I posted on Facebook, I think I posted my prediction, and I knew that TCU had a chance. Like, I knew TCU had a better opportunity than a lot of people were talking. But I just assumed that Michigan was going to sit on their Joe Moore award-winning offensive line and just run over this 3-3-5 defense. And I do not know if it's a – I don't know if it's a thing of they couldn't or if they just didn't do it. If they outthought themselves. TCU deserves all the credit in the world. Like, they've been doing this all season. They've been beating people who they were underdogs to. They've been, you know, I'm not taking anything away from them. I just was so surprised of the way the Michigan played that game. J.J. McCarthy looked so lost. Those two pick sixes, that is because he did not know how to read the defense. He did not know how to make his reads. And then, like, you know, everyone wants to talk about, oh, was it a touchdown or was it not? I think that's moot. Don't fumble the ball on the freaking goal line, regardless of a touchdown or not. Go ahead.
Yeah, you think about it from the standpoint of Michigan was just a little less sloppy. You know, their rematching with Georgia in the national championship game. Because Max Duggan throws two interceptions, they don't go back for interceptions. So, I mean, even if you just don't fumble the football on the goal line, then, you know, maybe you win this ball game, by a point or two, like Georgia did.
Yeah, which I'm sure we'll talk about their game here in a minute.
I left it off of my list because I figured you'd have it on your list.
Well, yeah, let me talk about the game, though, that my favorite bowl game outside of the Georgia game first, if you don't mind.
I don't.
Thanks, I appreciate that. It has to be
what we're doing here. So figured
out it has to be Arkansas Kansas. For me, Arkansas Kansas, like Jaden Daniels, or no, yeah, Jaden Daniels,
yeah. Jalen Daniels,
Jalen Daniels. There you go. There's JT, Jalen, Jaden. Jalen Daniels had 544 yards passing, five touchdowns, and he was 37-55. Like those are incredible stats. Arkansas wins 55-53 in triple overtime. Arkansas had this game won. Like it just kind of felt like it was D-U-N. It was done, done, done. And then all of a sudden, this team, this Kansas team, who has been impressive all year, just makes an 18-0 run in the fourth quarter to come back and win. Or come back and tie it and take it to overtime. You know, now they lost. But, I mean, I have to say, like, this was one of the most, like, outside of the playoffs and maybe the big, big boys, I just felt like this was one of the most impressive games of the whole year, actually.
Yeah, and it happens all the way back on the 28th and sort of kicks off some of the craziness of the bowl season. And, I think you're right. Arkansas and Kansas was absolutely incredible. And I kind of left it because it was sort of all Arkansas there for a good portion of time, like you said. And on the way back home, I'm getting the updates that it's getting tight.
Mm-hmm. This was just a really fun bowl season. You know, we don't have to talk about them. I just, just want to mention, like, Washington, Texas, like you already said, Oklahoma, Florida State. I mean, heck, Minnesota, Syracuse was really good. Notre Dame, South Carolina. You know, Notre Dame showed that they've got some dudes coming back. And, you know, Pittsburgh, UCLA. It was just a great year for bowl games. And the whole, bowl games don't matter. Well, let me tell you, man, these kids show that the bowl games matter to them, you know? But the other game for me, it has to be the Georgia game. I made the prediction that Georgia should, I picked Georgia to win. I thought Georgia should win, you know, if you just look at logic. But I told anybody who would listen, and, you and I tried to get together to record before I left to go out of town that, last weekend, but it just didn't work out. But, man, I really, really think that Ohio State should have won that game. Like, I actually do believe, like, the better team didn't win. Like, are you completely against that? Or how do you feel?
Not completely against it, but I'm not hardcore subscribing to that because
yeah, if like, the I'm better team. I'm not going to fight anybody.
Right. I just mean if the better team had won, I think the better team did win because Georgia made the necessary adjustments in the second half.
Yes.
And got the crucial quarterback play down the stretch. You play four quarters. You don't just play the first half and then survive the second half. You have to play the second half. And Ohio State ultimately didn't do it as well as Georgia ended up doing it, especially a Heisman moment kind of performance from an unlikely source there in the fourth quarter, going 10 of 12 for 190 yards and two touchdowns.
Yeah, like you and Graham both, like, have sent some great stats out about this game. You know, you just said it about the fourth quarter, and, you texted that to me either that night or the next day. And I of course, was blown away by, but just how good Stetson Bennett was in the fourth quarter. I think, like, I understand at the end of the day that, Stetson and CJ Stroud had similar stats. You cannot tell me that those two had the same game. You know, like, and I mean that as a like promotion or a proclamation for CJ Stroud. That dude played the best game I've ever seen him play. He had pressure constantly coming at him. He was able to move in the pocket. He was dropping dimes left and right. And everyone can like say that you know you can wipe this away if you want. But if Marvin Harrison Jr. doesn't get hurt, I do not think Georgia wins. And I feel fairly confident in saying that because the dude was just unstoppable. You know, he wasn't scoring a bunch of touchdowns, but we just could not stop him. You know? Like, did you feel frustrated by just not being able to stop him throughout the game? And that's not even on Ringo. It's just the lack of pressure.
I don't know. I think Georgia was down 21-7 and took a 24-7 lead or a 24-21 lead with the Harrison in the game. So
but then they scored
I know
40 seconds.
Right, they did, and Georgia certainly had their hands full, but I don't think it was impossible for them going forward, especially when you consider how well Stetson played in the fourth quarter. It's kind of like, you know, that's going to keep them right there. Now, still, I understand what you're saying. Georgia might have lost the ball game, but yeah, I don't know. I feel like there's a confidence that they would have figured it out. And when they did have Kelee Ringo against him, Kelee seemed to have some numbers, but maybe they didn't have him against him enough to have a, you know, a real.
Yeah, actually,
a real assessment of how well he played against him.
I have that stat. Hold on. All right. Or I've close to that stat. CJ Stroud, of his stats, of his, you know, 23, I'm sorry, of his 34 completions, or I'm sorry, 34 pass attempts, he targeted Kelee Ringo 13 times. He only completed 6 against Kelee Ringo for 69 yards and a touchdown. One of those touchdowns was against Marvin Harrison Jr. But I also saw another stat where, you know, Kelee Ringo didn't get as abused as people thought was going on. And I was able to watch some, like, I didn't get to watch a ton of it, but like I got to see clips of like the film room tape of the game. The reason why sometimes I just hate ESPN's camera views. The reason why a lot of times we were seeing Kelee Ringo making tackles on receivers who were open is because he was recovering and making up for someone who's messed up in their coverage. Like, he was covering for a lot of people throughout the night, and it doesn't show that in the stats because a lot of people like graded him poorly. But I mean, he only gave up 6 catches. 6 of the 23 completions, he only gave up 6. He had 7 incompletions against against Stroud. I just, like, you look at the game, they're up 10.
They're up 14 two different times.
They're up 14 at the end of the third quarter. Marvin Harrison Jr. gets hurt at the end of the third quarter, and then Georgia goes on that 18 to 3 run in the fourth quarter. I think you're absolutely right, though. The credit does go. I've had too many people around me in my life bash CJ Stroud and Ryan Day in this game. I think that's why I'm taking this time to, like, as a fire hydrant to, like, spew out that, like, no, they both called and played incredibly well. You know what I'm saying? Like, I've just been holding
on. I was having this conversation earlier in the week with our women's basketball coach, and she happened to mention on a whim about how women's basketball and men's basketball are, you know, uniquely different, where women play quarters for 4 quarters of 10 minutes, and the men just play 2 halves, and this is college basketball. And you've just got, you know, 2 20-minute halves in the men's game. And she was talking about almost as if she enjoyed and thought it was important in the women's game, and sort of what was special about it was that you have to go quarter by quarter and you have to have end of quarter situations and, you know, whatever all the other things. We didn't go in depth with her thoughts on it, but just a quarter by quarter kind of game, and you break things down that way. And I'm of the mind of, when I talk about a football game and I'm really dialed into it, it's quarter by quarter by quarter by quarter. And on Monday, after that weekend, I didn't say anything about CJ or Stetson Bennett's overall numbers. Never read them off once, because to me, it, I think you said this earlier, the overall numbers don't matter, because the game's not played like that. It's played quarter by quarter. And every time you stop a quarter, you reset the clock and you move everybody from one side of the field to the other. It's not a complete reset, but it's kind of like a reset. It plays on your mind that way. And no. Spencer, so I've always looked at it from that standpoint, that Stetson, CJ played a good game overall, but he was not the same quarterback in the second half that he was in the first half. And the same thing for Stetson. He was not the same quarterback in the second and third quarter that he was in the first and fourth quarter.
Yeah, he had a much better first first quarter than most people think he did, as far as Stetson Bennett.
Stetson, yeah, sure. Yeah, he did.
Okay, so I know that I have at times talked about certain games in quarters, but I have never looked at it the way that you just prescribed it. And I think that's probably a really good way to look at things. Because you're right. There is like a soft reset once that clock hits zero at the end of every quarter. You know, for me, you got to look at the, you know, key plays of the game are obviously, you know, everyone wants to talk about the timeout. There's no way you can't talk about the timeout as being right. One of the key plays of the game. I think also Go ahead.
I was going to say the timeout on the fourth down play that they almost converted with 12 people on the field that the referees didn't catch.
I send you that?
It was huge to begin with. And I think my brother even texted me, or somebody texted me. Maybe it was you. That was a huge timeout to take there, and it absolutely was. And then on Monday, we're all realizing, oh, it was that much more important because there were 12 people on the field and they converted the play right as, I mean, and just the perfect timing of the play, I guess, feels pretty impactful as well in terms of when he called the timeout. But yeah, just huge moment there, because then they have some sort of procedure penalty and they move back fourth and six and have to punt it away. Huge moment there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think it won Georgia the game. I think it won Georgia an opportunity to win the game. Yes. Does that make sense? Because like Georgia was still losing.
Right.
Georgia was still losing when that happened.
Yeah, it's the second half. So yeah, every little thing counted for Georgia. I mean, even going back to the Marvin Harrison play. I mean, that's them on the 9 yard line, 8 yard line of Georgia. And they're throwing that football and Georgia.
It looked like he was throwing
him moving backwards. And, yeah, throwing back off his back foot. And if that safety comes in and hits any differently, you might have a targeting play and a first and goal and another touchdown. And that could be the end of the game. So, yeah, I mean, every little thing in that second half from the defense for Georgia was crucial in order to, you know, battle back into that game. You're down 14 to an incredible offense that's been having a really great first half and a really great night overall.
Yeah, it really did come down. It came down to small plays. You know, the Marvin Harrison play, like, look, it was not targeting. Was it close? Yes. If they called it targeting, was I going to be dogmatic and say absolutely it wasn't? No. Because, no, it doesn't have to be helmet to helmet for it to be targeting. Like, that's what we also need to grasp. It's not always helmet to helmet. It is hitting the head of a defenseless player. And so I don't think it was. But I just think it was close. But I think that
definition, that second half of the definition that you just gave, changes it, doesn't make it targeting anymore, in my opinion.
Yeah, I
mean,
no, I agree.
What I'm saying is, I think you changed the definition in that second part of the, or you changed the term, because that definition that you gave doesn't match the term targeting. I think if you're targeting, it is the helmet to helmet and an intentional helmet to helmet crown and that kind of thing. you can clearly tell in the replay, which is thankfully that they have it, and this is why it's important, is you can clearly tell he's leading with the shoulder, and then the helmets come in contact with each other after the shoulder hits. That's a different thing from targeting, in my opinion, or from how I understand it, that I think I would have been a little bit more on the dogmatic side of, no, that wasn't targeting and it shouldn't have been called that, because he leads with the shoulder and hits with the shoulder first, and then the helmets come in contact. And maybe I'm just being stubborn, but that's a part of football, in my opinion.
No, I agree with you. I just so you know, like I'm reading the rule from like the sports book.
We're creating definitions for words, Robbie. God.
Yeah, I know. In 2008, the original rule was no player shall initiate contact and target an opponent with the crown of the top of his helmet. When in question is a foul, it was added later that no player shall initiate contact and target a defenseless opponent above the shoulders. So, like, that second part had been added. But anyway, it is a big play. And just like, you know, here, it wasn't targeting. Thank God it wasn't targeting. It was a good hit, a good football play by Javon Bullard. And it, like, there's three plays in my mind, and then we'll move on to the news story that we wanted to talk about tonight. There are three plays that I think culminated into allowing Stetson Bennett to throw a huge touchdown pass. One is the timeout, which we already covered. Two is the Marvin Harrison being taken out of the game, which we already covered. And also to give credit to Ryan Day and that coaching staff, because it was under the impression of Marvin Harrison Jr. that he was good enough to play, but the coaches did not feel like it was safe for him to play. And in this day and age of what we got this Tua situation going on, just kudos to the Ohio State staff. I do want to say that. But to me, Spencer, the other play that plays a huge factor in all of this is the Brock Bowers Jedi Force, I'm going to levitate over the out of bounds and get the first down. The play ends.
No,
it ends with a field goal. You know, it ends with a field goal that freaking Pod was finally able to make. But that field goal started the comeback of the second half.
Yeah. Huge play there for Brock Bowers, keeping the hand in bounds, and almost as if he knew it. Almost as if he knew, as long as my hand is in bounds, I'm still advancing the football forward, even though I'm not on my feet and the ball's going out of bounds. It was almost like he had an understanding of what he was doing in that moment. So yeah, what an opportunity there for him to get that, and like you said, ends in the field goal. But maybe you put enough pressure on them by taking a few more minutes off the clock, because that's right at the beginning of the fourth quarter, right? That's the first field goal of the fourth quarter, right?
I think so. Hold on. Yes. Yeah. There's 10 minutes and 14 seconds left in the third quarter. It is a 13 point game after that field goal with 10 minutes to go, and Ohio State goes 3 and out after that.
Yeah, and only takes a minute 13 off the clock, and then it's the 76 yard touchdown to Arian Smith. So the Dogs flip the score by 10 points in a span of, you know, just
a minute 2 minutes
off the clock.
Like a minute 33. And just Kirby has just grown so much as a coach. You know, this whole team has been just so impressive. But we'll talk more about them in a second. Spencer, the story that I wanted to make mention, and you agreed, was the hiring of the Texas A&M hiring Bobby Petrino as their OC. Now, there are different layers to this. I don't really want to dive into why you and I despise this man. We'll just make it clear we despise this man, and we actually have good reasons to despise this man. However,
yeah, from a football standpoint, yes.
Yeah. However, if Jimbo Fisher is honestly handing over the play calling duties, and he is going to let Bobby Petrino call plays and not be bothered in the middle of games, I'm not kidding, Spencer, when I say I think this means Texas A&M is going to be the team that everyone feared they'd be. They've got dudes. I don't care how many players they had transfer out. They still have dudes on dudes on dudes. They have a high blue chip ratio. They have a really good quarterback in Wegman who's going to be there this year. If you allow Petrino to change your offense and call plays, and Jimbo Fisher will take his hands off like a Kirby, like a Saban, I am not going to lie. Like, I am kind of concerned with having to go to College Station this year as a Georgia fan.
Yes, I agree. From a football standpoint, Bobby Petrino is, you know, the bee's knees, the arms and the legs, however you want to say it. He's a really good coach.
He's the only coach. I'm sorry, we don't go there in 2023. It's 2024. But he is the only coach I have ever heard Nick Saban multiple times say, "I hate coaching against his offenses." You're talking about Bobby Petrino.
Yeah, you put that kind of talent with somebody that can sort of unlock it and do so quickly. He's been a guy that's been around for a long time. He's got head coaching experience in the conference. You're bringing in not only a good offensive mind, but perhaps you're bringing in another just really good coach to add to the room and maybe be a right-hand man of sorts, because he's got just as much experience as you do. And again, especially within the conference. So if you can make things easier for your star athletes, which we've always understood that Jimbo's offense is, complicated and such, if you can make things more simple for those guys and just let the horses run, it could go a long, long way. And I guess Connor Wegman will be the quarterback next year. And if you can kind of get set in who your personnel is, especially at that quarterback spot, and then let the horses go, Bobby Petrino's the one riding them, then you're going to be in a good spot. And I think as a offensive coordinator, you can, kind of stick him in a room, put him up in the booth. Yep. Nobody ever has to see from him. Nobody ever has to hear from him. You don't have to worry. You take some of the pressure off of him. Just come in and run my offense, please and thank you. Don't need you to do anything else. Just run my – well, I'm sure some recruiting, but just run my offense, please. And then go home and do whatever it is that you do.
As a head coach, he is 137-71, Spencer.
Say that again, 137-71?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a really good stat. That's a really good record as a coach. But he's known for his play calling, whether it was his stint, his years at Arkansas. Like, I remember them more positively in some ways. Yes, it had a horrible decline very quick. And maybe one day I'll tell the story of me playing golf with a former GA from Arkansas and them telling me what really happened that day, with the motorcycle accident. But like what he is going, like, offensively, what he's known for is his time at Louisville, and not the bad things, but the good time of the offense with Lamar Jackson and how freaking unstoppable that offense was. And you're walking into a situation like you said at A&M, where you're going to have dudes on the O-line at wide receiver and running back. You're going to have a defense that actually, that's actually going to be able to help you. I just think it's hilarious. We've got, what is it? Is it? We now have Petrino, Jimbo, DJ Durkin, and who's the other former head coach? It's not Narduzzi, but it's a former ACC coach. This is gonna bother me.
At South Carolina?
I don't know.
Satterfield?
No. Hold on. All right, you give your take real quick while I'm looking this
it's
up.
I've got Bobby Petrino in 14 years at 175.
Steve Adazio.
Oh, okay, Steve Adazio. Okay.
Yeah. Very, very heavy personalities in that room. But keep going. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you interrupted, because I misread my numbers here. I've got him at 119 and 56 you must have his numbers while at, like, what, Missouri State or something?
I've got his overall college numbers.
Which would include Missouri State?
Yeah, I guess.
Wherever he's been at these last few years is at the FCS level?
Yeah, where he won Mountain Valley something Coach of the Year.
Mm-hmm.
Missouri Valley Football Conference Coach of the Year.
Yeah, that's it.
I'm just saying, like, if Jimbo finally does this and he does it correctly, it may be what all of us were worried was going to finally happen.
Does he have a choice? I mean, I understand what you're saying in terms of would he actually do it or be hard-headed and get himself fired? But I guess that's the thing that you sort of makes it feel like he doesn't have a choice, because his job's up against the wall, and it feels like Texas A&M could be in a position to say, or really and truly not just Texas A&M would say, but that he has his back up against the wall, and if he gets fired, I mean, he loses out on, you know, a lot of future opportunities, I guess, is he'd get fired for a pretty penny to leave Texas A&M. I understand it wouldn't be from a money standpoint, but from a career standpoint, he would, I mean, he'd get work again, but it's like, how long would it take for him to,
like,
he's got to be towards the end of his career.
This is the meal ticket, right, for Jimbo. Like, this job, I'm talking about, like, A&M, unless you do something here, great here, you're not going to get a better opportunity, a better paycheck, a better contract than what you have right now. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, no, for sure.
So, I think, and I was talking to some buddies today, like, at lunch, in 2 years, his buyout will be low enough to where Texas A&M can pull the trigger. In 2 seasons, he could be fired. So
yeah, you got to make a decision, or you got to make a change here.
Yeah,
an interesting one to make.
Yeah, it is. But we'll talk more about that as, you know, the offseason goes along. Spencer, it's time. It's time for the big dog. It is time for the last game of the season. It is time for the national championship. It is time for the University of Georgia versus the TCU Horned Frogs. We've got the sleeping giant that has been awoken after 41 years of last year winning a national title, being able to go back-to-back for the first time in a decade, versus the Cinderella story, the team who had never died, the team who did not have players, or last year was, or this upcoming season was picked seventh to finish seventh in their conference, playing in L.A. in Sophie Stadium that's not going to allow freaking tailgating. How are you feeling about this game just initially? And we'll talk about some matchups here in a second, but how are you feeling about this game initially?
Yeah, almost like a too good to be true. Almost like too many things are leaning in Georgia's favor. They've got the spread and they've got the talent and the blue chip ratio. And, you know, it just feels like too many things. Not that everybody's dogging TCU and laughing at little old TCU. It's just the narrative is still big dogs versus little frogs and the upstart little frogs, as if they weren't a really good program just a handful of years ago, and maybe more than a handful, but a couple of handful of years ago. So initially, I'm kind of like, as a Georgia fan, you're thinking this is a great opportunity. I felt really good about Georgia against either TCU or Michigan. But now that the conversations are starting and you're thinking TCU's hearing some of this, I don't like the bulletin board-esque material of us against the world kind of things. Georgia still unequivocally has the talent advantage, but to some degree, that might not matter if TCU comes out inspired the right way.
Yeah, I mean, my initial reaction is the same. Like, Georgia has been the number one team in the country all year, even in my hesitancy at times. Like, they have been the number one team all year. They have returning players. They have players who have come back over the last month that has drastically changed the way this offense plays. Also, I mean, I mentioned this during when we were talking about the Peach Bowl. I kind of think the injury to Darnell Washington kind of helped our offense on against Ohio State, Spencer. Because most of the time we run that 13 personnel and that 12 personnel constantly, that double tight. With Darnell Washington out, we were not able to run that all the time. And we were forced to run more splits with our wide receivers, have A.D. Mitchell and Blaylock and Arian Smith on the field at the same time, which we had not seen really all year. And so it allowed our wide receivers who we have, who are dudes, who we rarely throw to on a, like we don't spread the ball out to our wide receivers a lot. It forced us to. And I think that was the biggest takeaway that I had, or the big idea coming into this game over the past week was, I wonder if the inverse is going to happen, because it sounds like Darnell Washington is actually going to be able to play. I think that actually is going to be a benefit against TCU and this 3-3-5 defense that they run.
Yeah, it'll be interesting, because certainly when Georgia did do the two tight end personnel and went with Oscar Delp, it seemed as though he came through. I think Oscar helped seal some of the edge for one of Kendall Milton's touchdown, or his one touchdown. So Oscar Delp certainly did his part. And yeah, maybe Georgia was a little more versatile and kind of kept moving things around, took Oscar off the field a little bit more. So, you know, sort of limiting his responsibilities, which might have been a benefit for sure. But yeah, I was reading something earlier that said TCU's three linebackers averaged 6'2", 245 pounds, which in today's linebacker world, you know, 225 is more like your linebacker. So you almost have three kind of old school looking linebackers. And if Brock Bowers and you can get Darnell Washington on the field, kind of eating up some of those bigger bodies, might go a long way for what the Dogs want to do for sure. Just to have a big body to eat up a big body.
Yeah. Fun field fact, Darnell Washington's mom has never been able to see him play at Georgia. And
no kidding.
There's a collection of Georgia fans, because they, you know, I think they're from Vegas. There's a small collection of Georgia fans who got together and have set up for her to be able to go to this game. There ain't no way he ain't playing. Like, mama's yeah, gonna sure. be there. There ain't no way he ain't playing. All right, Spencer. So like, let's start at the top and work our way down matchup wise. When you think about Kirby Smart. Excuse me. And you think of Sonny Dykes, you know, they may not have history together. They have history from the same place together.
History with the same coach.
Yeah, exactly. They have history for the same coach. What do you think of whenever you think of this matchup between coaches?
Yeah, so Sonny Dykes obviously is running a version of the air raid that he learned from Hal Mumme, Mike Leach, and Chris Hatcher at Kentucky.
All of them
were together at Kentucky. Yeah. And then Hatcher leaves Kentucky and heads down to VSU. And that's where he and Smart and Muschamp get together. You feel as though, especially through this amount of time, Kirby has plenty of experience with the air raid. Every defensive coordinator has plenty of experience with the air raid. I think the one thing that obviously seems to separate these two coaches, Sonny Dykes is almost having kind of like an outlier type season. We never really suspected anything like this from Cal. I know Cal was never necessarily bad under Sonny Dykes, but we were never anything along these lines. And a time at SMU, and Kirby certainly has the more big game experience playing in a national championship of his own. SEC championships against Alabama, other big games against them and LSU and whoever else, high-profile matchups. So you obviously feel like you give the edge to Georgia just because Kirby and a good majority of his staff have been here before. Mm-hmm. And Sonny Dykes is kind of in a new area, a new spot, with, you know, riding a super hot hand there at TCU.
Yeah. I think I pretty much echo most of what you said. I think, you know, we've had to learn through some growing pains with Kirby as our head coach, you know, never being head coach before. And we just look back and you know, everyone goes back to the fake punt against Alabama. But, like, you know, there's just been there's been moments against, you know, like early on against Georgia Tech or against Kentucky or Vanderbilt. There's just this coaching decisions. You're like, what are you doing? I mean, heck, even throughout this season, it's been frustrating at times with, you know, at the end of halves of us not being able to decide whether we're going to be aggressive or not. I just mean, like, Kirby has had to learn at a prestigious program like Georgia, you know, off the cuff with no head coaching background whatsoever. You know, Sonny Dykes has had time as a head coach prior to. And I think that is probably why Sonny Dykes has been able to handle this year so well. And, you know, I think they had 16 transfers come in. He has, you know, Sonny Dykes has just done such an incredible job coming into the season. And I would give the lean to Kirby, but it's not because of Kirby. It's because of the staff around Kirby that I would probably give him the lean. Even though I think Riley is an incredible play caller for TCU, Lincoln Riley's brother, for those that don't know. But yeah, I would give it to Georgia there. Let's look at Georgia's offense versus TCU's defense. What do you got going on there?
Yeah, so was reading a little bit earlier today. Both teams seem to spend a lot of time in a 3-3-5 defense and or something like that.
Yes.
So you get the impression that Georgia's going to have some real familiarity, some recent familiarity with what a 3-3-5 is going to look like. Obviously, you get all the film and you break all that stuff down, and, you know, you got coaches on top of coaches that can get all that stuff organized. But you have the familiarity because it's what you were running as Kirby on the, you know, being the defensive guy, and you got Muschamp and all of his experience on that side of the ball as well. So you feel good about what those coaches can bring to the table as a benefit to helping give Todd Monken a few extra notes here and there about, you know, things to go after. But you feel good. You feel really good too, if you're a Georgia fan, about how well Todd Monken has done attacking anybody. Georgia was averaging what, 38, 39 points a game this season, and found a way to score a bunch of points here against Ohio State and outgained Ohio State on a yards per play kind of basis. So for all of OSU's success, Georgia outgained them.
Yeah.
So you certainly feel good about the groove that Todd Monken is in, the groove that he and Stetson Bennett are in. I guess that's one of the big fears is, what kind of rut does Stetson Bennett get into if he gets into one at all? Two quarters worth of a rut against Ohio State included a couple of throws into tight coverage that Ohio State dropped, interception opportunities. Well, you saw TCU put their hands on interception opportunities and take them, you know, the distance. That doesn't mean they'll have pick sixes against Stetson, but if Stetson tries to fit things in, because he's forcing it and he feels the pressure of the game, much like what happened in those second and third quarters, if that takes place here, well, you know, TCU might have their hands on a few more interceptions than you know, just the one that OSU got. So I think you certainly have to keep that in mind. Where how level-headed can Stetson stay for the entire game? How long of a rut does he get in? You know, how big of a rut, and then how long does he stay in it? And then Georgia was held to 12 rushing yards on 12 carries in the second half against OSU. Is there any way for TCU to mimic that sort of success with unique looks and formations and, you know, different things that they do with their 3-3 stack and other similar looking things? So Georgia has had its issues, it's felt like, this season with running the football, and you might can tell me more about that. But I feel good about Georgia, especially from the talent standpoint. But, yeah, I think those would be the concerns, because I think there was a moment in the third quarter against Ohio State where Stetson misses Brock Bowers going down the field on what could have been a big play on 2nd and 6. Stetson misses him sort of high and outside, throwing over his right shoulder. Missed him bad. And I think after that miss, Todd Monken in the offense kind of said, all right, we might need to adjust our play calling here for a minute until Stetson figures it out again. And then you started to see the next two possessions were dumpster fires, because I got the impression it felt like the play calling changed because maybe Stetson had lost it a little bit.
Yeah. I mean,
my biggest fear about the offense is what kind of a rut and how long does it get into, and what sort of advantages can TCU take off of it if it happens?
No, I mean, you heard Kirby at the end of the game. Like, they win the game. Stetson Bennett has that incredible fourth quarter, and then he's asked about Stetson Bennett, and he doesn't throw him under the bus. He critiques him. He says if he would just play within the system that he's been given, you know, like, they know what limits he has. And, but here's what I would say. Like, I don't know what Kirby was referencing, because whenever coaches say that, everyone automatically assumes, well, you know, this is like, he was overthrowing this guy or throwing interceptions here or there. Like, Stetson wasn't doing that. You know, plays just were not happening the way that we normally see them. And look, we also, like, this is not talked about because it's not going to get talked about, but Brock Bowers was sick in that game. I've been told by two different people that would know that he was sick during that game.
Mm-hmm.
Against
and leading up to it.
And Jalen Carter was also believed to be sick as well. And so I think both Darnell Washington getting injured and Brock Bowers not being 100% definitely hurt at times, because he didn't have his blanket that he normally has. But here's the thing, to go back to what you're talking about with rushing the ball. Since the month of November, the Tennessee game, I'm going to give you the yards per game that Georgia had since the Tennessee game. Okay? 3 yards per carry, 5 yards per carry, 5 yards per carry, 6 yards per carry, 5 yards per carry, 5 yards per carry. Georgia, I don't know if this is that the pass is opening up Georgia to run the ball in the end of games to just crush their opponent, or if Georgia could be running the ball way more and they're just not. I don't know what the answer is. I do know that getting Kendall Milton back for the past two or three weeks or past two or three games has been vital to this, because he's averaging like 7 yards a carry. It may be 8 now, but this Georgia team offensively is way better than we know what to do with, because Georgia fans don't know what it feels like to have a top 5, top 6 defense. And that's what we have. And that's just crazy. He's averaging 7, Kendall Milton's averaging 7.5 yards a carry this year. And that's with 75 carries on the year. So Spencer, where do you think, is it the offensive line where Georgia has the definitive, like, I may not know what's going to happen with Stetson. I may not know what's going to happen with our wide receivers, but I know our offensive line is big, physical, and good, and can and should be able to move TCU. Is that kind of where you're at?
Yeah, I mean, yes.
Okay. I agree.
Yes, I think Georgia will be able to run the football. That'll give them an advantage, and I think Stetson Bennett's a better quarterback than J.J. McCarthy. He's certainly much more experienced than J.J. McCarthy.
Well, that's 'cause he's
and that
36.
Probably goes a long way. Yeah. That probably goes a long way into if Georgia gets into a stint where they can't and TCU has kind of clogged things up, then you feel good about Monken and Bennett finding those opportunities to, you know, to recap, you know, take advantage of whatever they're doing to take over. But yes, Georgia has the offensive line that you feel is bigger, better, stronger. Bowers and Washington being healthy, rotating in Oscar Delp as needed. He seems to be doing good with his blocking assignments. So, yeah, you get those guys in there, and the three-headed running back of McIntosh, Edwards, and Milton all feel like, you know, that's a real promising place to be for Georgia running the football.
Okay, I'm going to say this, and I'll be done with my offensive part for Georgia and TCU. I think Stetson Bennett's legs was not used hardly at all against Ohio State. And I think he's about to run the ball a whole lot in this game against TCU because their linebackers are not as fast as Ohio State's. They're not as fast as LSU's. They're going to run this 3-3-5 where they play this blanket coverage where they try not to let anything go over the top, even though they did get beat several times against Michigan's okay wide receivers. I really could see this being Stetson Bennett's final game in a Georgia uniform. I honestly could see him have a YOLO, not in the sense of getting rid of, you know, like throwing the ball wherever he wants, but I think he's going to do some things with his legs in this game. I feel really confident about that too.
Yeah, 8 rushing touchdowns on the season.
Yeah. All right, Spence. So on the other side, when you're looking at TCU's offense against Georgia's defense, you know, like so many people, like the blanket statement by a lot of Georgia fans is, well, Georgia's defense is just so good, TCU's not going to be able to do anything. Uh-uh. I don't buy that at all. TCU has – I saw the stat earlier, like – they have a higher ranked offense than Georgia does. And the weakness, I don't want to say weakness, but the things that have been able to get Georgia have been quarterbacks who can move in the pocket, maybe even mobile quarterbacks, and one or two NFL caliber wide receivers. Well, guess what TCU has? They have a quarterback who loves to move in the pocket, even with some many would call him mobile. And two, a first round caliber wide receiver in Quentin Johnston. They have the formula to attack this Georgia team. Offensively, that is.
Yeah, Johnston with 59 catches on the year, 18 yards per catch, 6 touchdowns. He's been very, very good. And it sounded like they didn't do a lot of down the field stuff against Michigan. They did a lot of sideline to sideline shorter stuff that really got loose.
Yeah, like Georgia did last year on them.
Yeah. So my biggest fear is Duggan's legs. I think that's going to be I get the impression that Georgia's going to bring pressure, and they're going to have to try to be very strategic about it, and that's a given. But they don't want to leave those running lane opportunities for Duggan to get out and go, because C.J. Stroud had a really good game running the football, and that was something he wasn't necessarily used to doing. Duggan carried his team with his legs in the Kansas State Big Ten championship game. Like, he's not afraid to take the ball. He's got on the year, Duggan has 127 attempts. he's not afraid to take off running, and he's scored, and he's gone for 683 yards gained. He's got some yards lost, I think, due to sacks. But in terms of him going downhill and going upfield, Duggan, you know, he's not afraid to take that, especially, you know, when you got nothing to lose in the last game of the year. So Duggan's legs are a big concern for me, and they've had some big playability down the field with the Johnston kid. If Georgia can take him away mostly, then you're still got to deal with a group that's, I don't know. You still got to deal with several other guys that have been key. After him, there's four more guys that have, 18 touchdowns between the four of them, mm-hmm. and 36, 37, 29, and 22 catches. So you feel like there's not massive guys that have been just uber productive. But if you take the one guy away, there still feels like there's some options there that, you know, you just got to keep your head on a swivel for everybody. But again, Georgia in the second half handled what Ohio State had to bring to the table. And I feel good that if Georgia can do that in the second half, make the adjustments, figure things out, settle in and get going in the second half against what Ohio State was unstoppable doing in the first half, and then go the whole four quarters against Tennessee and all the things that they did and stopped LSU just enough. Like, I heard somebody say Georgia hasn't had the experience against high-level offenses yet, and I kind of think, man, they saw a lot from LSU. They did what they did against Tennessee, and they took things away from Ohio State in the second half. I think they're getting enough underneath their belt to this point to say they got a good chance to slow down an offense that's maybe not powered by a quarterback quite like what they've seen in Stroud, Hooker, and even the Garrett Nussmeier kid. Max Duggan's a good football player. I mean, he's a caliber football player, and he's going to put his legs to use, and he's not a bad thrower. But he's not those guys throwing the football. I don't get that impression from other people either, that they think he's that kind of a quarterback throwing the football. So,
yeah,
I feel good about Georgia defensively, I guess.
No, I would agree, and I think one of the things that the reason why I mentioned I talked about Keely Ringo. Is because I actually think that Keely Ringo struggles more with the shifty stop and go type wide receivers. And that's not what Quentin Johnston is. Quentin Johnston is tall, jacked, who likes to run go routes or slants. And I think that's what Keely Ringo does best at stopping. I think he does incredibly well against this. So I actually think we're going to see Keely Ringo on an island with him. Following him when he's in the slot, Keely may move in, or Javon Bullard may be on him. I mean, look, Quentin Johnston could get his. He may get a touchdown here. He may get one long play. I don't think George is going to get eaten up by him the way that Marvin Harrison Jr. did, because I don't think they're the same type of wide receiver. It's like DK Metcalf. Like, I really do think Quentin Johnston is more like a DK Metcalf type, where it is more of these like go routes, you know, slants or post routes, as opposed to these more complicated double moves, which has been given Keely Ringo such issues. With that said, I think if George is able to do that, if they're able to put Keely on put Quentin Johnston on an island with Ringo, I don't know what wide receiver they have that George is going to get eaten up by. And so that leaves to this question of, offensive line wise, Ohio State has two first round picks at tackle. They have a center who's very good. They have two guards who are fairly good. They double team Jalen Carter most of the night, and Georgia was not able to get much pressure, even though I think they ended up with four sacks on the night. I don't think TCU's offensive line is going to be able to do what Ohio State's was. That's my big takeaway. Is like a lot of the things that help CJ Stroud and helped him dice up Georgia's defense is because I really wish I could find the stat of how much time Stroud had in the backfield to throw the ball all night. I think Georgia's going to be able to get pressure on the
most of the night. It was a pretty nice number.
Yeah. No, it's okay. Thank you. I don't think that's going to happen for Duggan. He takes a lot of sacks. Like he takes a lot of sacks, and a lot of sacks are like, as Tom Fernelli mentioned in their preview, a lot of times those sacks are because of him, or because of Duggan. And I just don't think that quick getting the ball out quick stuff is going to work on Georgia the way it did on Michigan, because there's one thing Georgia does better than possibly any other team in the country, and that's tackling. Michigan had so many broken tackles in that game. And so for me, I cannot think or believe that Kirby, Muschamp, and Schumann are going to let their defense get exposed again, especially against a team that offensively it has talent but is not as talented as Ohio State is. I just don't see how that happens.
Right. Yeah, TCU's given up 1.7 sacks per game, 24 over 14 games. Georgia's given up 9 over 14 games.
How many have they given up? I'm sorry. Say that again.
TCU's given up 24 over 14 games. That's almost two. Yep, that's almost two. And then Georgia is giving up 9 sacks over 14 games.
All right. Defense.
Georgia has 31 sacks defensively over 14 games, which is just over two.
Yeah, they're not great at creating. They're not great at getting sacks, but they've gotten better as the season's gone on.
Well, I'm saying that 31's more than two. So I mean,
that's fair. Yeah.
And was the pressure that they did get on C.J. Stroud was enough at the right times. I mean, you go back, I'm sure you saw this clip. They needed 10 yards to make that a 40-yard field goal or whatever. They run a play, and C.J. Stroud is looking to his right, and he's got an open man coming on his left. They run a go route with the wide receiver on the outside, and then it's like a little in and out to the sideline route by their number two receiver who wears number two. And he was open. If Stroud was looking left at that play coming open, he hits it. They get the yards that they want, and I wouldn't have been surprised if it was a 40-yard field goal to try to win the game. But Stroud is looking to his right. Pressure comes from his right. So as he's moving to go back looking left, and he's nearly wanting to throw the football, but the pressure's on him just in time, and he's got to roll out of there, rolls right against the grain, gets away from it, and throws the ball away, leaving it to the 50-yard field goal. So while Georgia, like you said, doesn't get a ton of sacks, I feel good about, and I got to believe a lot of people feel good about Georgia getting pressure on the quarterback. Especially a guy like Duggan. If you can make him move, C.J. Stroud can hurt you with his arm on the move. If you make Duggan move, maybe you get some opportunities there if people can hold up in coverage.
No, I agree. Georgia does this thing, and they did it a lot, especially in the fourth quarter against Ohio State. And I think it ends up being one of the biggest deciding factors as far as changes from Schumann and Muschamp, is that they started doing, like, they did the interior blitzes. Like, they just started bringing Munden and Dumas Johnson up the middle to get their pressure. And I they were doing that because they couldn't get pressure on the outside often, even though Michael Williams, a freshman, had an incredible sack. I don't think Georgia's going to have to do that. I think they will be able to cause disruption and get – I think they're going to be able to get pressure on the outsides. So, Spencer, I I have to mention this, though, before we talk, like, before we get finally to our pick. I don't think you can turn away or ignore the freaking just voodoo that A&M has had all season. Right? Like,
TCU's had all season?
TCU. I don't know why I said that. Yes, TCU. Like, it really has been like this weird voodoo of like just things go their way. They're able to make these comebacks. They may be the most battle tested team in the country this season. I think for me, no lead is safe in this Georgia game. No lead is safe because I've seen this happen all year. How do you feel about that?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought you had
no,
more.
No, my fault.
No, I mean, yeah, TCU has been a fighter all season long. And if you can come to the big dog and put up a fight, that could potentially go a long way. The problem is Georgia's been pretty feisty themselves. As long as Georgia comes in and is not hanging their head or not looking to the clouds too much, thinking they already have this one because TCU's this little upstart, you imagine Kirby's going to have them thinking better than that, especially with it being just one game left and you're not just playing a game. This is for all the marbles. You'd get the impression that TCU's going to bring a fight. Georgia's going to bring a fight too. And if they both do that, Georgia should have the advantage just, you know, based off the talent. So I get the impression Georgia's going to have the kind of success that they want to have. TCU is without their number one running back. It looks like they're going to continue to be without him at least. Mm-hmm. So Georgia's going to be in a good way because some of the banged up players that have been out for them, they're going to get some of those guys back. Not all of them, but they're going to get some of those guys back. And the ones that they're going to be without, they've been without for a good portion of time. So those backup players know what they're doing. They understand their assignments and such. See, it's, you know, TCU's been an incredible team, and no matter what happens on Monday night, it won't change. They've had an incredible year. But I think it feels like the Dogs just have too much. They just got too much.
Yeah, I don't see Georgia winning this game in a close match. What I mean by that is if Georgia wins, I think it's because they kind of just destroy TCU. But if TCU wins, it is a close battle towards the till the very end.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that.
I'm picking
What's
Georgia.
The smallest margin you could see Georgia winning by?
17.
Bill Connolly's S&P Plus has them winning by 10, 34-24.
I
haven't looked into it to what he has said about it. I just saw what the score was.
It really just goes back to Stetson Bennett's last game. Darnell Washington's mom's going to be there for their last game. This O-line, most of this O-line, they're all going to the NFL. This, you know, Jalen Carter, last game as a Georgia, you know, in Georgia uniform. Chris Smith, last game in Georgia uniform. Probably Keely Ringo's last Georgia game in a uniform. And they're, you know, TCU has this too of these guys who will never play for TCU again. But I just think of these studs. And, you know, Georgia's been here before. Georgia knows what this is like. They know the environment. They know what they have to do. They will show up and be mentally prepared for everything and anything. And
did you see the tweet earlier today from young lady where she said that, oh boy, TCU had a DJ and players taking pictures with the 2023 sign. Georgia, in all capital letters, straight up business. It's quiet and the players are walking straight to the buses.
Yeah, I saw that. That that also plays a role in this. Maybe these guys are just happy to be there.
To some degree, yeah. Perhaps.
To some degree, yeah. Give me Georgia. I don't have a score. But I really do think that, I mean, 17 is probably too high. I probably see Georgia winning by 14. Yeah, probably by 14.
Yep, I could easily see that as well. Easily see that as well. Georgia just should just have too much. For sure. All right, Robbo, anything else?
Well, what do you got? Your pick.
Oh, yeah, no, Georgia. Georgia.
Okay, I mean, okay. I just didn't hear you say it. So
I'm sorry. Yeah, no. Georgia for sure. I don't think I have anything else. I'm trying to make sure there was nothing else on my mind. But yeah. Okay. I do appreciate that ESPN article from earlier this week that sort of tied Kirby and Sonny Dykes back to Hatcher and Hatcher tying them back to VSU and, you know, also there to Kentucky where Hatcher and Dykes were together at. But that article was really cool reading a lot of those different stories, some of them that I had not heard before, you know, Kirby diagramming a play and leaving a player off. You know, it's pretty funny because I've had a chance to hear from Chris Hatcher before, and I had an opportunity to interview him recently on my morning show. And if you've got an idea of if you know Hatcher and you know his way of going about things, he's a uber confident guy. And to sort of hear that story in his voice, it's all pretty funny stuff. If you haven't heard from Chris Hatcher before, definitely go look up some YouTube videos of him in interviews. He's a pretty funny guy. And then read those stories and read them in his voice, and it's pretty funny.
No, I agree.
A lot of good stuff.
I've met him a couple of times whenever I was in school and he was at Valsa State. I think I was in high school, though. I had a chance to meet him a couple of times. He was always super nice. I like him, to your point. Yep. Spencer, it's been real. I'm so excited to be able to record with you again, and I look forward to recording with you next week.
Yep, and hopefully we're talking about a Georgia victory, and if not, we'll be talking about a historic moment for the TCU Horned Frogs, which will, in its own right, be very exciting, even if we're a little bit heartbroken in the midst of it.
The Frogs and Dogs.
The Frogs and Dogs. It'll be a lot of fun on Monday night. Be sure to like, rate, review, and subscribe. You can find Robbie online at SpiderDude64. That's Twitter. And you can find me there as well, Spencer_VanHorn, VanHorn. Two friends, one love, and that is college football. We'll catch you on the flip-flop. Later.